Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with luminaries of reason, Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mengu Ward, and Matt Welch. And today we'll be discussing why people hate libertarians and or tackle them while mowing the lawn, the Democratic sweep on Tuesday's election, Donna Brazile's revelations about the DNC, and the Texas shooting. We'll kick it off with Senator Rand Paul, who is recovering from an assault by his neighbor, having received 6 broken ribs and a pleural effusion. Although, so far as we know, the spat was not actually political, rather based on a longstanding dispute over homeowners association, possibly involving stray yard clippings, planted saplings, or unraked leaves. In any event, his neighbor got into a fight with him, or rather tackled him from behind. One of the interesting things about that development, I think, is not so much the neighbor himself, but rather the reaction that the media has been having to Rand Paul getting assaulted, which is alternated between kind of gleeful about a libertarian getting attacked, or alternately saying it's bad that a senator was attacked, but understandable because he's libertarian. So, Matt, you wrote a piece about the Rand pile-on for a reason. Why is everybody so accepting of Rand Paul getting tackled?
Well, first of all, we're going to have to fact-check your premise, Heaton, here, because there's been a vigorous pushback from the Rand Paul camp about the role of lawn clippings in this.
He's saying he's a good neighbor?
Saying that, you know, he's just like any other member of the Homeowners Association, very diligent about his lawn clippings. And so his friends are now going into the media and saying that it's not a plausible explanation. So
there was a great Washington Examiner article today, which was literally just 20 quotes from everyone who knows Rand Paul in
all
his
of them
neighborhood.
Written, clearly just written,
clearly
scripted.
And the headline was Rand Paul's neighbors rip media quote landscaping dispute reports.
Well, I should have done like Google views of the neighborhood to see, you know.
Oh, we did. We tried.
So I mean, I wrote a post highlighting, you know, 3 or 4 particularly idiotic takes on this. The worst was the one that I put at the end of the update. There's a Above the Law blog, which is a pretty delightful lawyer blog. There is a piece that was semi-tongue-in-cheek, but not really, saying that, yes, I'm saying Rand Paul had it coming for 17 years because he's a libertarian. And it was just sort of this rant about libertarians and property rights and all these kinds of things. This is, to be sure, the exception and not the rule. Not everyone is standing up and plotting. The two most common responses are, you know, boy, that escalated quickly, and what the living hell? And I think that is a pretty appropriate response, because no one can figure this out. It happened a week ago. A sitting senator got tackled and had
which 6... is a big deal. Like, that, there's a lot of federal offenses involved with that, right?
Yeah.
And the Homeowners Association code, I'm sure, does not look fondly on that.
Tackling?
Yeah, it's probably anti-tackling.
It's neither composting nor tackling.
Yeah, you're supposed to be wearing flags, and when you're mad at a neighbor, you just pull one of the flags.
But this is something that we saw not necessarily in terms of violence on Rand Paul. But anytime he comes up in the news, he has what I call the weird man's burden. Just because he's a little bit ideologically different, he's also kind of short and he's got curly hair. Everyone treats him a little bit like a freak. And say things that they wouldn't say about Bernie Sanders, even though Bernie Sanders is, I think, equally freaky as Rand Paul.
Walking head cold.
Arguably. I mean, if Bernie Sanders got tackled in Burlington by an irate golfer, you know, would there be 5 or 6 people out there, not just like randos on Twitter, but people who write for GQ? GQ had a piece that was titled, let's face it, something along the lines of, let's face it, Rand Paul is an asshole, which is just, I don't think that's what we'd be saying about Bernie Sanders if he was convalescing, you know, with bruises and fluid in his lungs.
Did we have any hot takes that were like, now that Rand Paul has been tackled, will he finally vote to outlaw tackling? You know, like we have when people get shot, like the Republican softball league guys.
We still don't know anything. I mean, the doctor who tackled him, because
Rene Boucher.
Yeah.
We're naming and shaming.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it's just a funny
name. Yeah, the name is
Trevor Noah has Rene Boucher. Out.
But it is, I mean, beyond the yard stuff, the articles I've read were that he obviously disliked Paul's politics and the two hadn't spoken in years.
That's under some dispute. Some people from the Paul camp, they're like, hey, they haven't talked
about
it.
I can't believe there's a Paul camp on the yard tackling. Sure.
But it is fucked up. I mean, to go back to Andrew's main point, this is not Steve Scalise being shot, which was also, to be honest, it's amazing how quickly that story blew over, where a guy opened fire on a baseball field of congressmen and I guess a couple of senators. But this is I don't remember this type of story very often where a, you know, and especially Paul was just cutting his grass. Right. I mean, it's like.
Yeah, they weren't arguing about health care. It wasn't something that escalated.
Yeah,
from
it wasn't at a town hall and it became a pushing and shoving match, or they were reaching for the last Cabbage Patch Kid in a crowded department store in Christmas or something. It's like, I don't know. I don't think this is a trend, but it's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think that there's something inherent about just being on any kind of seeming fringe where people feel like that's, you know, but the real story is that, you know, the Dixie chicks are fat, you know, that kind of thing.
Can we push back on that, though, of like, you know, what's fucking weird about Rand Paul's politics, ultimately? I mean, you know, and obviously we're four libertarians sitting in a room, but it's like, oh, gee, he's like been consistently against wars that every fucking American has hated for at least a dozen years. And if you're smart, for all of the 21st century before they started even, you know, he's for reducing government control of healthcare. He wants to actually cut spending. You know, there are things I disagree with him about, but it's like he's totally in the American mainstream.
This is something that I'm curious about. Like, so I came into libertarianism. I was a moderate Democrat and I came in through kind of Milton Friedman and P.G. O'Rourke. And at the time, I thought, oh, this is going to be, in addition to liking the ideology, of course, I thought this is going to be great because all the liberals are going to like me because I'm socially progressive, and all the Republicans will like me because I'm fiscally restrained. And that is not the case overall. It tends to be both camps dislike libertarians because the Republicans sort of view them as pot-smoking turncoats, and the Democrats view them as very suspicious kind of Aspergery Republicans. So even though it is more mainstream and weirdly more centrist, there's also more pylon to libertarianism from conventional thinkers.
There's also the way that libertarianism gets expressed in two-party politics is not the way that libertarianism exists in the wild or in this room. So if you're a libertarian Republican in Congress, you're going to be super, super anti-abortion and introduce the Life Begins at Conception Act, which Rand Paul has done serially. There is no exception to that rule. Libertarians in the wild are much more pro-choice than they are here. And so,
but you never hear – that's not why people hate Rand Paul, right? They're not like, oh, and he, you know, all he talks about is abortion, because he is very anti-abortion. And I think he's wrong about that, but – he doesn't talk about it that much, at least not to general audiences.
People are taking their cues, though, from the way that Rand Paul is treated on the Hill, at least on some level, right? He's the kid that people don't want to sit with at lunch because he's not consistently reliable yeah. as a Republican voter, although he's more reliable than I think the people in this room might like as a Republican voter and endorser of Republican candidates. He's not, you know, he's not team red.
So you're making a pretty good case he deserved to be tackled.
No one deserves to be tackled, Nick.
Thank you.
Well, aggression principle.
I wanted to ask about that as well, because on Twitter and on some of the sources that Matt pointed out in his article, people were saying, oh, libertarians and the terrible neighbors because they're only about property rights. But to get kind of wonky about it, I mean, aren't libertarians very big about voluntary association where you're opting into a group or opting out of a group? So I feel like, you know, there's no reason that a libertarian would go, fuck it, I'm going to mow my lawn whenever I want.
It's a complicated story, Andrew. On one hand, yes, of course, libertarians are looking for non-state solutions and agreements among one another. But also, temperamentally, many of us don't like being told what to do. And so those things are – I hate homeowners associations, partly because I'll never own a home and because my mom –
Just pure by class
choice.
Resentment.
By choice.
I'm happy they exist. I just don't want to have anything to do with them. My mom lived in Irvine, like the most famous planned community in the country on some level. And it was just a nightmare of like you can't park this kind of truck in your driveway. It's awful. So I think both things can exist, the intellectual appreciation for them, but also straining at the leash of their petty rules telling you what to do.
Mm. All right.
So how do you fix that misperception that libertarians are somehow – I mean, I don't really get that, Andrew. I also don't hang around with conventional politics people. I don't know what I'm saying here, but
you don't even know the word for them anymore. Yeah, you're that far outside of the mainstream.
The papas,
the normies,
the conventional thinkers. Yeah, normies. That's
but what needs to be done? What is to be done to purge or to cleanse in the blood of the lamb?
Wow,
what's happening?
Kidding. I don't know.
I'm
waiting for the next episode of Westworld. I need the next season of Westworld. I need a reboot.
So to reveal purge, blood of lamb, death robots.
Yeah, now it's cleansing.
It's somehow
cleansing.
How we're solving the homeowners cleansing. Association.
What's the reboot? What's the reboot for libertarianism so that we're not being tackled while cutting the grass?
I mean, I think it's a couple of things, because when I talk to people, again, when I brought up the Republicans.
Yeah, by the way, did people like you when you were a moderate Democrat?
No, people still hate
me.
I will say you can blend in a lot more. If you're just a moderate, I'd say I don't think as a Republican now that would work. I wasn't a moderate Democrat because I wanted to avoid fights. I mean, I became a Democrat during the Bush years in college and you know, stand by that decision. But no, it's a lot easier to not get into unnecessarily combative fights, I think in large part because people are really tribalistic. And it's really important to people that their laundry is the same color as your laundry. If they're on blue team, you're on blue team. So if you're a Democrat and you're pro-market, they're not, or you say that, they're not as angry as, say, I'm a libertarian, which I don't think has a mental peg for a lot of people. They know what Republicans are. They don't really know. They've seen Ron Swanson. So they think it's a guy with a mustache that's kind of anti-authoritarian.
Not wrong.
Yeah, that's pretty much covered. That's like 90%.
But the idea that there's actually... you just created in my mind a vision of a world in which you wear the color of like underpants of the party that you vote for.
You just kind
of
like, so what's like drop your pants a little yellow? Bit to show.
That's yellow for the libertarians.
Yeah, lose on the aesthetics. You
know, I mean, did they choose yellow or did yellow choose them?
I think it's Gadsden yellow.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the anarchist, you know, the anarcho-capitalist flag is yellow and black. There's a lot of...
Well, okay. You guys were, I don't know, the socialists would be what, bright pink? That would be there? Because you were out slugging away at the socialists last week.
Yeah, Nick and I were... Nick and I had a...
Fighting the good fight.
Well, why don't we... What
were you going to say? Is there something... I think
a large part of it is that most conventional thinkers who, for the most part, just want to fight and like, yay, my team, fuck your team. And there's not a lot of ideology that's actually at work. If you're not fitting into one of those two boxes, it's irritating because it's nuanced. And the thing that I think would be helpful is going, this libertarianism's classical liberalism is an actual philosophy that's separate from conservatives and liberals. And you might happen to be
is it separate but equal?
Separate but equal, yeah. But it's different and not just like a pot smoking Republican or a Democrat who likes math. That it's an actual separate thing.
Although
it's those things too, though. I mean, I just want to be clear. We would love to have the pot smoking Republicans and the Democrats who like math use our.
And like I would love it if the, kind of the Bill Weld Republicans, if more of them came out and came over. But
Matt, you were saying that I was right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, just that to bolster Catherine's specific point about Rand Paul is that Paul delights in occasionally being, I don't know if troll is the right word, but he enjoys being the contrarian, throwing sand in the gears. He wants to constantly hold roll call votes instead of voice votes on foreign aid, which nobody wants because everyone just wants it.
Want it done without having their name associated
with
it?
Yeah, because foreign aid's unpopular, and he's like tried over and over again to do that. He will be the one guy to force a vote and therefore delay by 5 months Montenegro ascending into NATO, and John McCain will accuse him of collaborating with Vladimir Putin as a result. He's that guy. So he's already kind of inherently irritating to a lot of people.
So don't mow the lawn while in the Senate, because they'll attack him.
Yes, they will.
It's going to be the caning of Charles Sumner all over again.
Doesn't he have like four sons? Like, why isn't one of them cutting the grass? That's what I want to know as a father.
It's probably how he unwinds.
Now, an entire
column by a guy named Bernie Dickerson in the Detroit Free Press was musing on why was Rand Paul mowing his lawn? There is an answer to the question, which at least according to Fox News, so it's true, is that he finds it therapeutic.
See? Told you. This is like a subtype of human that I will never understand, but which I fully believe exists, of people who like find their zen on the riding mower. Like,
was it a riding mower?
He
got tackled off a riding mower. That's super dangerous.
He was standing near the riding mower?
It's unclear.
He got tackled
was he sitting on
the riding mower?
Oh, that's even more dangerous.
But definitely wearing the earmuffs.
I thought he was listening
to
music.
Again, like that's like you tackle the guy wearing the earmuffs on his riding mower, right? Like he's
there's nothing.
You want to give him a wedgie? Like
it's not like Mike Dukakis riding a tank. It's like you wear that.
It would be great if Michael Dukakis wore the exact same outfit while mowing his lawn.
Oh yeah,
really enjoy.
Or if he showed up at the first debate wearing that helmet, and he was
or
like,
if
but
he
I always
Rand
wear.
Paul. I think there's a lot of things.
But I don't think he could. I mean, he's scrappy. He's kind of like a free
safety.
Shows us
once again an important lesson. And that is all too forgotten in the modern world, particularly in this city that we're sitting in together in the flesh in Manhattan.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Ooh. You were saying something about a stroke.
don't wear headphones. Don't put stuff in your ears to block out the noise. There are dangers everywhere, including the neighbor who's going to tackle you. Catherine, you know I'm right. In your heart,
I was trying not to laugh.
I got noise-canceling headphones for Christmas last year. My life is so much better.
Only when you're in an office behind a locked door facing...
That's the worst. You're more likely to be killed in your office or to be tackled
in your
office.
You are one of those people that likes to sit with like your back to the corner, aren't you?
Every time.
Yeah.
There's two uses for headphones. One is everything is already locked. No one can come in and you're just going to listen to Jim Ladd's headsets and smoke a bowl of a pot. And two is if you're trying to work in an office with Nick Gillespie. These are the two acceptable.
You were
going to
say, and also when you're using the metal detector on the beach in Long Beach, trying to find keys and old cans.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Matt leaves that to his dad.
You can totally see Matt with a sifting cup, like
just wearing a jock strap walking down the beach.
Bring this back a little bit.
Save us, please.
Because I do want to get a recap of the debate. We talked about the debate you guys had last Friday before you went and did it.
Proactive, or prescriptive.
Mm-hmm. It was a preview.
You've now done it. How were the socialists, Nick? Did you enjoy the debate?
Yeah, I did. They're nice guys. And, you know, as always, it was more interesting in the back room where we were talking about stuff that we tended to agree on. And I'm interested in Catherine's take. I mean, we've obviously talked about it. But there was, you know, I don't know how much we conversed with each other as opposed to at each other, because the worldviews were, you know, genuinely different and distinct, and not even getting to the point of philosophy, and Catherine, jump in here, but it was the starting points, because the Jacobin, the people on stage, as well as Michelle Goldberg, the New York Times columnist who was the moderator, they literally live in a world where people are enslaved to jobs and have to wear diapers at their desk because they're not allowed to leave.
Because of the power of the capitalist class.
Yeah, and to set wages and terms in every part of your life. And I think I live, and I suspect you do, Catherine, where that is not reality. It's not even reality in the fucking third world, much less in America. And as a result, we were missing each other in multiple ways. But I do think it was interesting, and it was good to hear what they had to say, which was mostly that, you know, we are in advanced capitalism or late capitalism. The center can't hold because, you know, capitalism is immiserating too many people in the world. So the end is nigh for capitalism.
And
it just doesn't comport with the basic facts.
So my takeaway was it was a room. There were about 900 people in Cooper Union Hall. It was a huge room, probably about 800
of
them.
You were definitely the visitor. I listened to that last night, and you didn't have equal representation.
No, but I think I'm not exaggerating when I literally say 800 of them were left-oriented. But the thing that that I wished we had pre-gamed better, because I realized it toward the end of the debate, was that those 800 people weren't actually Jacobin magazine-style socialists who wanted to empower the working class. They were Brooklyn progressives.
Yeah, they were bougie people with scarves.
And the thing that finally kind of hit, I think, a little bit of fertile ground toward the end of the debate was when Nick and I started talking about, you know, the world that these Jacobin people want is a world where the pie is being divided up by the working class, which means that they have incentives to not let immigrants come in, to not really care about marginalized people. And that they'll admit that. Like they say, we are not doing identity politics leftism. We are doing class politics leftism. And, you know, I believe that capitalism is great for marginalized people. I believe that capitalism is great for the people who are below the working class in a way that that the socialists sort of want to pretend those people don't exist or don't matter. And the couple of lines that I think landed with the crowd. And my goal for this event was just to, like, go from being perceived as, like, Maleficent to Cruella DeVille.
Evil person.
Right? Like, I just want it to be like, hey, have blue hair and I'm pretty nice.
Wait, isn't Cruella worse than Maleficent?
No. She's magic evil forces summoned inside her body. Cruella just wants a coat.
Yeah.
I mean, she kills puppies, but also I hate dogs. So
pick
that's
a different. Oh, okay.
No, but I was trying to say, like, I didn't think that I was going to be like fucking Glinda by the end of this thing, right? Like, I just wanted.
I like your Disney scale, by the way. I think this is very useful.
I just wanted to move slightly down the maybe these people aren't fully evil scale.
Know, Matt wanted to be Ariel from the Little Mermaid.
He is in our hearts. He's the best singer among us.
I think everybody kind of wanted to get semantics out of the way, but I think you could have done that, or the debate could have done it another 10 minutes, just because it seemed to me that listening to them...
Well, we were just never going to...
No.
There was no hope for semantic agreement.
You know, in a way, I mean, and I agree with Catherine that it was interesting and totally worth doing. And I'm not sure that you said that.
No, it was great. I had a huge amount of fun,
And the Jacobin guys were really nice. I mean, really they set up things very well. And
complimented your jacket at one point.
I guess so, but
it was mocked/complimented.
Yeah, doesn't matter. It's all being tackled, isn't it? All being tackled.
Yeah, it's bullying.
Cutting the grass, but if we got through to some of the people there and talking about when you look at the world now, what do you like in the world, and what are the things we agree on, and then kind of work back from those points of agreement. Of what are the institutions, what are the mindsets, what are the social configurations that allow that, it may have been more productive because a lot of the people there, you know, they like what they like about New York is the proliferation of lifestyles and of living spaces and of food and of different identities, but different
experiences. And that was not what the Jacobin people were
They're doing something different. Yeah.
Yeah.
And each of these people, I think, are fundamentally wrong because the Brooklyn socialist types have no respect for how capitalism, they mock Whole Foods. Whole Foods is to them what, Safeway is to Whole Foods. But it's important to understand Whole Foods and all of the stuff that contributes to it is totally libertarian. And then the socialists, the Jacobins who aren't into identity politics or any of that kind of consumerism necessarily, they got to deal with the fact that China is richer now because China is less communist, period. There's no mystery there, and it doesn't mean China is a place anybody wants to live from the West, but it's better. And that's where I wish that I had framed some of my arguments. I think Catherine was more effective in throwing things out there.
In reading op-eds and part of her book, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, who are not libertarian, would nonetheless agree with the statements you're making. This broad idea that markets are a good thing, that capitalism's the engine driving the economy.
And that was why this crowd was fun, right? Because I do think we have the opportunity to engage mainstream Democrats pretty often, but this was a crowd that was to their left. And so it was a different discussion.
Which I got to say is kind of disturbing because not that I think the Red Scare was a good thing and McCarthyism was good, but if you wanted to pick a group to obliterate, I'm kind of glad communism
down
was
boy.
It.
No.
What does that even mean?
I'm saying what I mean is I felt like socialism had more or less been destroyed in American discourse.
The idea that socialism doesn't work and we can stop now.
I thought that the Cold War had kind of conclusively done that.
This is where the Jacobin people, in a way, they were disappointing in that they were ultimately more redistributionist, I think, than hardcore.
They just wanted, they were kind of Denmark, like but with Sanders. More worker political power.
Didn't the Prime Minister of Denmark fly over to America to correct Bernie Sanders that they're not a socialist country, that they're a market economy?
No, and actually on various kind of well-being indices, the U.S. and Denmark are neck and neck. So it's, this is a real challenge for libertarianism, isn't it? That in many contexts, we're like, oh, France, we're the anti-France, or the anti-Denmark or the anti-Sweden. In fact, the difference between Sweden and the U.S. is relatively minor in the scheme of things. And maybe this is something that libertarians need to understand, that if you're rigidly saying it is my kind of anarcho-capitalist dream of zero taxation and zero obligation to neighbors, then you're a party of one. But I mean, if we're basically talking about limited government that's going to redistribute some money, and allow economic growth and a lot of economic and civil freedom, that's something we should be getting behind.
Part of it is correcting the record of among both Sandersites and a lot of libertarians about places like Sweden, which we had in the Bernie Sanders issue in like April or May of 2016, a great piece by Johan Norberg, which was like, yeah, actually, Bernie, America should be more like Sweden. Here's how. And the time that Sweden followed a Bernie Sanders-like economic program is exactly when Sweden tanked and people, you know, ABBA left the country. It was so bad. And it was only after.
That's a hell of a sentence right
That's
there.
That's a wake up call.
Well, and they, I mean, just in general, I think that the when our progressive friends in America are sort of lusting after Northern Europe. And it's you know, they have far less regulations. To start a company, as I understand it, in Sweden or Denmark, you basically go into an office and go, I'm starting a company. And they go, oh, great, good luck with that. Whereas here, like in New York City, if we wanted to start a business, we have to you literally have to book ad space and newspapers to announce the creation of it. There's like three different agencies.
Bill de Blasio's
you have to go through.
Shoes. It's very
like they're far less regulated than we are. They do
Except,
have higher taxes.
But and then on the labor market side, though, this is where the business regulations aren't as bad, but the labor regulations are much worse. But they have school choice. They have a variety in Sweden. They have a variety of programs.
And a lot of these places sit on just big buckets of oil, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Offshore drilling.
In the end, the point I would have liked to drive home a bit more at the Jacobin Reason debate was, okay, so there's the crappy bastardized version of the system we would like to see here in America in 2017 and arguably in China and India in even crappier and more bastardized versions. But the crappy bastardized version of the thing you want to see is Venezuela.
Yeah.
So, like, our thing wins. That was like the place where I felt like, you know, maybe we should have ended up there. But I would totally do it again. It was absolutely delightful.
You can just go magazine by magazine. Like next time, the Nation, and then move on.
No, I think that would be a fun. That would kind of be a fun series. Actually,
Kat Murdy, who's the social media director at Cato Institute, had a great tweet about this where she was retweeting somebody saying people are scalping tickets because they were $10 a piece. To the Reason Jacobin debate, and she just read too long, didn't read Capitalism Won the Debate, which is kind of funny.
I just wish, I mean, last night, all of us, I think, Andrew, you were at the Atlas Network dinner?
No, I was not.
Good.
They're not just letting anyone in.
I strategically stayed away.
Atlas Network does an international kind of libertarian do-goodery out there.
Think tank developments
in all over the world. And it's a great shot in the arm to go to that dinner every year because you see people in Mexico and Brazil and France who are doing tangibly great stuff and celebrating and trying to further the eradication of poverty in the world by having more trade and good things. And I just wish that, there was a delegation from Cooper Union could go to that thing, too, and see this is what is motivating a lot of motivating a lot of people precisely about what excites them about libertarianism, capitalism, whatever, free markets. It's that. Eradicating poverty. That's great.
Rich people should get to keep a teeny bit more of their money. I mean, we like that, too. But I agree.
Not as good of a bumper sticker.
The Atlas Network always makes me feel like you know, we should probably all chuck it, move to Brazil and be part of the libertarian revolution there or something. Like that's, I do have these, that's my escapist fantasy is marching in the streets of Brazil. So.
Well, I'll turn it away from Brazil and Northern Europe and all of that and back to the United States because we had several elections across the United States on Tuesday, which Democrats swept across the board. They took offices in Virginia, New Jersey, New York, just a whole lot of places. And what's generally being described as a drumming by both sides. And then a lot of people are going beyond that, saying that it's sort of a canary in the coal mine for Republicans and Trump, and that this was a repudiation of Trumpism. I don't know. I don't know if that's just a regular thing that happens to the minority party that's more of a protest. But Nick, I'm curious as to your thoughts. If you thought that signified any deep element against Trump or if it's just horse trading.
Well, I desperately want to live in a world in which canaries and coal mines no longer exist. Coal mines for obvious reasons. Canaries are annoying. But I
we're
think
really
we're getting
like Dadaist Nick today. Yeah. I'm really into it. Carry on. Sorry.
Okay. I had a long conversation at the Atlas dinner about Jerry Lewis, who was an early. He actually did kind of like Dada humor in the 50s, which explains why he went insane and became the man that he did. But I don't think you can read too much into stuff right now, but it's definitely a big deal in Virginia that the Democrats maintained pretty easily. Ultimately, the governor. governorship there. I mean, Virginia is now pretty officially a blue state. Mm-hmm. New Jersey has gone back and forth for a long time. It used to be semi-reliably Republican, and now it's trending Democrat. And Chris Christie's governorship was a disaster, not just for the people who live in New Jersey, but but for the state party as well. And I think you see a lot of anti-Trump sentiments. One of the things that was funny was that Trump was claiming that Ed Gillespie, no relation, who lost in Virginia.
That facial expression was great, by the way. I wish everybody could
see that. Didn't embrace Trump enough. There may be something to that, because it could be that turnout, might have been higher if he could have gotten more of the Charlottesville, boys to come out. But
he was wanting to do what Trumpism minus Trump, right? Wasn't that kind of the strategy?
I mean, he's also, by various people, he's a mainstream establishment Republican who's tried various times to run for office and keeps losing. And I think we can get to where the Democrats are still in massive trouble, especially going into 2018. But the Republicans, Trump is clearly not a horse that anybody else but Trump can ride. It's just ugly and divisive, and most people can't carry it off to the low threshold that he was able to get into office. And then if you fall back on the establishment Republican kind of thing, where like Ed Gillespie was running, MS-13 has taken over. These they're not even Mexican gangs anymore. They're from further down in Central America. It's scary. They can talk about crime. They're not convincing on that, and people don't care about that as much. They suck on the economy. And every time they've been in power in the 21st century, they have blown out the size, scope, and spending of government. The Republican Party stands for absolutely nothing. And so I think it's hard at these statewide levels, and especially in places where it reflects on the national party. The GOP is in tough times.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Pendulums swing always. Nick and I wrote about this a lot in our book. And every time it swings, everyone's like, my God, it's
the
permanent.
The permanent Republican change. Majority.
And I actually, that phrase sea change, like.
Yeah, it's like canary in a coal mine. What the fuck does it even
well,
mean?
Well, I mean, it's like when the sea changes, it always changes back. So yeah, I don't understand, like
the tides.
Yeah,
the tides.
But people use the phrase to mean like a big, permanent, exciting change.
Yeah, it's true, really, right? The Atlantic Ocean doesn't like reorient itself.
No, it's not. No.
I think it actually is a tide. And the thing is, the tide was. I'll stop. Metaphors in the morning are just not a good idea for anybody. Even though Republicans kept winning all the special elections, like in Georgia, the Ossoff kid, and all this kind of stuff, those elections. Those districts were moving by about 15 percentage points on average, give or take, in the direction of Democrats. So places that were safe Republican seats became contested. So Trump was like, 5-for-5, 4-for-4 every time a Republican would win. But that was kind of not acknowledging the reality here. There was Kevin Williamson had a pretty decent piece in the National Review. The National Review. I don't believe in their naming structure.
National Review of what?
The New Republic dropped their "the" too.
Yeah. Did they really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they've been dropping a lot of stuff. They've been dropping more ballast than a hot air balloon.
Getting ready for the next debate.
Yeah. That 9 out of 10 people who identified as pro-Trump voted for Gillespie. 9 out of 10 people who identified as anti-Trump voted for Northam. And so that's why Northam won, because Trump isn't popular, and that's the math problem that Republicans face. And it's interesting to see how much everyone is federalizing and presidentializing everything everywhere. My local city councilman, who ran unopposed as a Democrat, he's the leader of the resistance. Like he hosts resistance meetings.
Hashtag resistance.
#resistance. He had November 7th or whatever. He like hosted a resistance town hall.
Percentage did he get?
The New York election guide online is terrible. It just said ran unopposed. I wrote in Jim Epstein because that's what you do. And I don't know how many other
he might have come in second place then.
I think so. Yeah. I also wrote him in
which
for a lot
means
of
that
judges.
The city councilman is going to be like, get this Epstein guy. I want him dead.
I was sitting there
don't let him leave the parking lot alive.
In physical therapy the other day, and they have blaring morning TV, which is a world. My God.
Physical therapy, Matt, or is it?
It's everything. But they had on election day, they had a bunch of campaign commercials, And it was one, and I don't remember who it was, but I think it was a lady running for mayor. And she's like, I'm going to stick on the issues that really matter to Republicans. And I'm like, okay, that, or not matter, but matter to New Yorkers. I'm like, okay, great. She's going to focus on local issues. And she's like,
fixing the subway. Fix the subway.
Fix the subway.
Goddamn subway. The F train. Fix it. God damn it.
Stop it. And she's like, number one, we're going to stop Donald Trump.
Yep.
And it's like, wow. That sad. Although I have don't mind at all to see Trump repudiated and Trumpism repudiated, because I don't think that it is a good thing. It's so sad to see how much that we just obsess over Washington, and we don't even know what happens locally, and we don't think in terms of that. That people are responding to market incentives, which is that we all look towards Washington. Everyone's obsessed with Trump. So, the pendulum swinging in this direction. I don't see it as anything like an enthusiasm at all for Democrats. It's an enthusiasm against Trump.
I went to Colorado a couple of weeks ago, and instead of hashtag T-shirts, they had Colorado T-shirts, and they would just talk about how nice the weather was. It was great. It was phenomenal. Like, I feel like here in New York, there is this sort of kind of permanent hashtag resistance, hashtag she persisted kind of, and like that's great, but it's exhausting.
I saw a gal on the way here that had a shirt that said, "I am a trending topic."
Nice.
Oh, that's pretty.
I was like, That's a positive message.
Did you snap that for the Instagram?
I should have probably put it on the snap faces.
Yeah.
One of the elections.
You just need the right filter, and then you'll get thousands of clicks.
One of the elections that got a lot of coverage in Virginia was Danica Roem. I think it's Roem, who's the first transgendered candidate to become
first known transgendered
to become a delegate in the Virginia State House, I think is the term. And she ran against Bob Marshall, who was a 13-term state delegate, and I believe he described himself as the homophobe in chief, if I'm not mistaken.
He did.
So
a chief homophobe.
Yeah, you were following this, right, Kathy?
Yeah. So this race is great because the person who you might think is the underdog, which is this 33-year-old trans woman who had kind of entered politics and was a new face, was actually also like the dominant player in this election. She outraised Marshall like 5-1 or something like that.
Really vigorous ground campaign. They knocked on 75,000 doors.
Marshall's 73 years old, described himself as Virginia's chief homophobe. His main accomplishment last year was introducing a bathroom bill, trans bathroom bill that died in committee. Also refused to refer to Danica Roem by female pronouns consistently throughout the race. And it was like watching a dinosaur be slowly beaten to death. And I personally enjoyed it tremendously, but I think people want to make a lot of hay out of this race.
What is it, like a brontosaurus?
No, like a little, like one of the little ones. Because toward the end, they in Game of Thrones, I assume the dinosaurs got smaller.
Yes, because the dinosaurs were kept in captivity.
Yeah,
they're basically chickens. By
sounds like Dino. From
it's like
the
a he was like a post asteroid dinosaur. Is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
And I think, the race, like, there will be a movie made about this race because it is so cartoonishly full of contrasts. And I guarantee you in the movie, Danica Roem will be, like, extremely scrappy and, like, have a shoestring campaign.
But
and that
she,
was not...
She was actually kind of wonky, like based on what little bit...
What does she stand for?
So, actually, that's the other thing I was going to say, is this race, apparently was... other than the trans thing, was totally about Prince William County's traffic problems, which is like that's
into the nitty gritty.
That's what America is about. It's about like fighting about how many lanes there should be on
the
highway.
The Reason Foundation could help them with that.
Yeah, well,
Bob Poole's
on the phone with her right now, being like, "Can we talk about hot lanes?"
Yeah.
He's going to solve the Prince William County traffic problem. So I don't know. I think it was a race that like people wanted to make a lot of symbolic hay out of, and they should. But at the same time, it was really about traffic and this old ass fading away.
But I could be wrong. I got the impression that he was the one that was kind of dragging the transgender thing into the light more. I'm sure that was a card that was played on her part, but.
She ran in response to his garbage record.
But she also knows a lot of the stuff going on. She's like a reporter for 6 or 7 years and like really knows Prince William County.
But she has the absolute worst band name I've heard.
She's in a heavy metal band.
She's a singer of a drunken thrash metal band called Cab Ride Home.
Ah, jeez.
It's not a good name.
That's like talk about looking backward. Why not Lyft Ride Home or
Tipsy Uber?
Uber.
Tipsy Uber is a great name for a K-pop.
Tipsy Uber sounds like it's one of the options on Uber. Like there's Uber X, Uber Pool, and Tipsy Uber, where you pay like $5 more, but they carry you to bed.
We actually talked about this in Reason a while back. There was an attempt to have Lady Uber.
Oh, really?
Where like if you're a drunk lady and you don't want to get in some dude's car, could you do Uber X?
Lady Uber sounds like a late Mark Knopfler solo song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he'd be sitting on the back of the car.
Right, Uber XX, get it? And there was a company, actually a separate company outside of Uber, that tried to provide this service and got in trouble.
Well, because women can't drive, right?
Well, that discussed on the Fifth Column podcast, which do we pretend that podcast doesn't exist because it's a rival podcast?
We cross pollinate.
When I was on Fifth Column podcast with Matt a while back, I did confess on the air to being a garbage lady driver. So it's best if we don't let.
You also live in Washington D.C. and everyone's a garbage driver by default in Washington D.C.
Dude, the two cities I've driven in are D.C. and Boston, and D.C. is basically
Boston,
like
worse.
A well-mannered, high-skill town compared to Boston.
I know at least two, I've driven with at least two of your podcast mates, Matt, including you. I think you're a good driver. But the other one, who will remain nameless,
terrible driver. They should put ankle bracelets on him.
Yeah, I mean, he should be strapped down like Alex in Clockwork Orange and not allowed to drive.
You're from the real America. You're probably a good driver.
You know, I'm
not from real America. He's from fake Texas.
I'm from the Canada of Texas.
Fake Texas is
still more. He's from the rounding part of the
Texas Lake.
Fake Texas is still more real America than anywhere that we're from.
I'm basically, if you took a Norman Rockwell painting and you shook it, I fell out.
Shook it until all the blacks and the Jews. You know, fell out and went down to Texas.
We've become far more diverse here recently.
Blushing is right.
But I also know statistics. Everybody thinks they're a good driver, so I assume I'm probably not. I think I'm probably like 3% less than a good driver. But I don't really drive anymore, so I think I'm terrible.
I grew up in New Jersey, which always has the safest. Yeah, it's surprising. I try to keep that hidden because it scares people. But New Jersey always by mile driven is always the safest state for driving.
That's just a lie.
The reason it is true is because you can't get your license until you're 17 in New Jersey. So you cut out that early year.
What would Lenore Skenazy say about your desire to slow down the adulthood milestones?
I haven't seen her behind the wheel. Would you get in a car with her?
Oh, my God.
We say that with love.
Yeah.
I'm going to push a little bit more into the Democrat story that we're talking about, and that is not so much the sweeping victory of the Democrats recently, but the terrible, terrible setback they had in 2016, which has been brought to light by, I believe the book's called Hack by Donna Brazile. Donna Brazile was the interim DNC chair.
Hacks.
She was the DNC chair after Debbie Wasserman Schultz departed, and she's been doing a tell-all.
Was fired.
They did the political thing right where they excused her to be a consultant or something, which is the equivalent of shooting you. But she took that over and is now saying that at one point she actively debated putting in Joe Biden and Cory Booker on the ticket.
Yeah, she actually never did that. What she said was the DNC chief has the option of starting a process by which the party would pick a different candidate. And she flirted with that in an excerpt. She mentioned in an excerpt. But the big news there, Donna Brazile was Al Gore's campaign manager in 2000, and short of about 500 or 1,000 votes, she would have become Karl Rove of the 21st century, and Karl Rove would have been seen as a loser. She has real tension throughout her career with the Clinton machine, but her book, and there's an excerpt in Politico, it's coming out soon, and then there's discussion of it. She discovered a very strange agreement between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC dating back to 2015, before the primaries had even begun, where Hillary Clinton's campaign was lending the DNC a lot of money. It was broke from spending too much and not taking in enough money because Barack Obama diverted most of Democratic Party fundraising into his Obama for America and Organizing for America after he couldn't run anymore. And it gave Hillary Clinton's campaign a lot of control over who was hired at the DNC and what kind of messaging they did. And it's absolute proof, and this came out last in the election through WikiLeaks, that the DNC, which is by its charter, is supposed to be neutral and just run good primaries so that the best Democrat wins, who will then go on to represent America, was totally stacked in favor of Hillary Clinton. And it's trying to be wished away now because it takes energy away from the idea that it's all about the Russian Facebook ads, you know, that 15 people saw. That's Brazil is saying that Hillary Clinton had massive control over the whole Democratic Party machine and kind of fucked up the election. And I think it's an important story, less because of what it says about 2016 and more as with the Republican Party, which is in a shambles organizationally. You know, the RNC is like, you know, floating around in a fishbowl somewhere, not doing anything, and Trump is awful for the party. The DNC and the Democratic Party is equally listless, and this is partly because the Clinton machine controlled it so much and for so long. You know, Obama was the single worst president for Democrats in history. I mean, he oversaw the end of their power at the state and local level and at the federal level. So to me, the Brazil story is interesting because it confirms what WikiLeaks had come out with last year during the election, and it opens up hope that the two-party system is not going to disappear, but it's really kind of sucking wind here.
It's interesting how much the Democrats are just going to keep relitigating 2016 over and over and over again. The amount of influence that the kind of Planet Clinton has had over the party for a long time and the sort of baked in, corruption's a strong word, but just sort of like hands on all the levers of power, which has been consistent.
And that she couldn't lose on her own. It couldn't be her fault.
Yeah.
It had to be the DNC. It had to be Bernie Sanders. Who did he think it was? Oh, it was the Russians. It was Donald Trump. Like, she can't be responsible for losing a race where, you know, she lost three major states that had always been blue. And she didn't visit them properly.
And know? I think the knock-on effect is that this is going to give extra kind of wind in the sails of the economic populists here. They're the people who feel aggrieved. The Bernie camp feels aggrieved. They're sick of corrupt politics as usual. They're right to be on that
point. Yeah, they got the short end of the stick.
Sadly, they're wrong about
economics.
Economics, and that's what's motivating them much more than other like civil libertarian issues. So we're in this kind of bad rut right now where the two parties are both kind of beset by populism, and populism always fails. It just definitionally doesn't work out, and then it breeds more dissatisfaction. So I don't know exactly how that goes. One would hope that this would help goose third parties out there, but that's not something to ever bet any kind of money on. So it's kind of a mixed up, shook up situation right now.
Yeah. Is it just in reading this story? I mean, a lot of the outrage, which is justified at the DNC being rigged. Is that really terribly new? I mean, and I don't mean that in the sense that they're, you know, terrible people, but the open primary system, that's somewhat new, isn't it? Like, I don't think we really did that till post FDR. And even then, I assume
that's a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, like, it's.
I was like, for what value of new are we discussing it? But yeah, no,
like, is there a golden age where the parties were great, is what I'm getting at? Was there a period where they were actual honest brokers of open primaries?
Yeah, I think there were times where races were fought more openly. And I mean, I have no interest in, I don't give a shit about the Democratic Party, but it's, you know, it's meaningful if they are afraid. Like, the only reason you rig an election is because you're afraid you're going to lose it. And, you know, that's a bad sign. And it shows it's a kind of rotting system if they can't act. You know, it's like when you have here is a job test, and the person who does best on the test, you know, tests all the parts that you would be good at this job, and we're going to take the best person unless it's a Kennedy. You know, unless like a Kennedy doesn't win it, so we're going to put them in. It's a sign of an organization in decline.
I also think the word rigged here is like so perfectly designed for minimum clarity and maximum sensationalism, right?
Thank you.
Mean, this idea of, you know, oh, it's rigged, and like that means everything from like, oh, I just happened to find these 10,000 ballots in my purse, I'll jam them into the box here, all the way to like the power dynamics that we all basically understand, in which like money dictates how nominations are play out.
Bernie Sanders thing, that, I mean, we all knew that during the they were getting screwed over, right? Like, that's not something that was shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of giant sweep of possible action that Rigged encompasses is because, you know, Fox News and lots of other people want to make a big deal about how something is very, very wrong when actually things are pretty, pretty normal.
Whereas, conversely, the Republicans were scrambling to try and get rid of Trump the whole time.
Well, and right. I mean, the Republicans are just mad that they couldn't rig their election, except for then they got mad when they won. But
yeah.
They,
and Trump was probably the only Republican who would have won in a lot of ways.
I don't know. Yeah. There's a less dark timeline, I think.
And Matt, I know, has written about this in a lot of different contexts. But, like, you know, the Democratic Party is obviously a mainstream party. And if they cannot incorporate criticism, like, from their voting base, like, they had a lot of people who were like, we want this, we want this, we want this. And it's not that Sanders had to be elected. But if you end up creating, when you make it seem as if the official channels – to use a Hillary Clintonism when she was talking about whistleblowers, like, oh, you know, Edward Snowden and Bill Binney and Thomas Drake, they should have gone through official channels. When there are no official channels to vent or to amend or to revise or reform your organization, you go outside it and you become more extreme. And I think that's part of what you're getting at, where this is going to result in the Democratic Party probably going for a more populist person, which is going to be worse for everybody, because it's going to, even if they don't win, they're going to pull the debate towards populism. And the Republicans are probably already there. When you look at a lot of, like, the bigger new wave Republicans, even Ed Gillespie, who was keeping a distance from Trump, started going on and on about, you know, El Salvadoran gang members and, you know, dusky hordes, you know, attacking Virginia. It's not good. I mean, you want these parties to be.
I definitely heard dusky whores just then. And I was like, that's where we are now.
You got to pay extra for that.
Pinch hitter for the Giants in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken.
I would have liked to see the, like, you know, Joe Biden, Cory Booker ticket as much as the next guy. Like, I think Donna Brazile's not wrong about that.
I think they would have done a lot better than Hillary Clinton did. I think Trump was a really weird phenomenon that kind of broke all the molds and all that. But Joe Biden's a lot more likable.
I mean, doing a lot better than Hillary Clinton did is winning. Like, she did very well. That's the other thing, is this idea of, like,
well, it's probably pointless to even think about this, but would any other candidate gotten 50% of the vote? Because for me, and this I find hopeful, that in this election, where you had a very established, you know, semi-centrist but very controversial candidate in Hillary Clinton with a huge resume and all of that kind of stuff, and Donald Trump, and, like, neither of them could get to 50%, which takes us back to the 90s when Bill Clinton, when he was running against Bob Dole, and he was, you know, the economy was going great. He had survived his first term, even though the House had gone over to the Republicans. He got like 46% or something, or 49%, excuse me. And that, I was kind of like, that's great. That, for me, that was the beginning of what Matt and I wrote about in the Declaration of Independence. Like, people are evacuating politics, you know, because, like, if you couldn't win in 1996, if you're Bill Clinton and you couldn't get like 52-53% of the vote against Bob Dole, who was talking about, like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger movies had too much violence in them, and, like, we got to build a bridge to the past. I mean, that was, like, part of his campaign slogan.
To be fair, Bill Clinton was also talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger movies.
Yeah, no, I get all of that. But I'm just saying, but it was, like, old man who had, like, just been found. Oh, we forgot he was in this root cellar for, like, 30 years.
Let's bring him out.
And as he's still blinking from the light. And he's like, oh, you know, I want movies where the girl gets kissed at the end. Or so, you know, I mean, it was, like, nuts. And Clinton still couldn't do well. And we've had a lot of contested elections.
I just live in fear of the day that somebody actually wins an election by a significant margin. Like, I mean, remember how people were like, oh, Obama is a mandate now. Right. Like, ooh, doggies. And it was like, you know, 1% or something. Like, God forbid someone actually have a mandate. If presidents do what they do now, if they take on the mantle of, like, infinite executive power on the strength of, like, not quite winning the popular vote.
Right? He won. He got 2 years to do whatever he wanted. And he created the greatest change election, you know, in our lifetime, which is kind of great.
But the idea of everybody doing that on the strength of, like, just marginal wins
Trump, right? Like, right. Oh, I won the biggest electoral victory.
Victory was impressive. So it was like, no, you got like five more votes than the other dude, like a gal. Let's be cool here, man. So God forbid we should actually ever have a party that attracts 60% of the popular vote.
Here is one quick thing that we can look forward to, because I was listening to how under Obama, everybody, even a lot of Democrats, were like, the presidency has gotten too imperial, like the president has too much power. I was just listening to NPR the other day, and a guy was saying, I fear for whoever follows Trump, whether it's in, 2 years or 6 years, because they are going to be inheriting a presidency that has been incredibly diminished.
Mm. Oh,
so now we're going to be like, it's like it. I mean, this is part of what Matt and I have written about. Jess, it is this pendulum thing where it's like, oh, yeah, it's all this and it's bad or terrible or it's great. And then it's the exact opposite with the same people flipping sides without ever acknowledging anything.
If only we had a presidency that was incredibly diminished. That's all I want. Much to ask.
I think like with some glaring exceptions, I think Polk was like, yeah, I'm here to do whatever Congress
Polk
wants.
Polk was terrible.
Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge, never go wrong with Coolidge.
Coolidge, terrible on immigrants.
I mean,
awful.
Great on napping.
Is there a presidential napper?
He set them all. Reagan was a piker.
But before we jump subjects, is there such a thing as a good president? Do you have presidents that you're like, that was a good president, I really like him?
No.
Okay. Catherine?
Some policies, but no, there's nobody that I would be like.
Can you grade him on a curve?
Why would I?
Oh, huh?
This isn't fucking college.
It's four words. Every president is terrible.
Yeah. That checks out. That's four. Yeah. Kind of that. Catherine,
it's the name of the children's book I'm writing with Lucy Steiger. I'm not even making that up. And Ken Lane's doing the illustrations.
I think that to say what Matt and Nick said is true and tempting, but also kind of abdicates some part of the discussion. And, like I say, I have a little soft spot for Silent Cal. The business of America's business is
so
the business of business.
I guess your family was here.
Yeah.
Your family was in the country.
I like that he took a big nap every day in the afternoon during his presidency. So
Grover
I
Cleveland?
Stick that.
I'll stick it for Grover Cleveland.
Sure. Yeah. Grover Cleveland.
Why is that funny? Why is that funny?
The only part, Calvin Coolidge and Grover Cleveland, no one else.
President.
But they're also, they're kind of like Laurel and Hardy. It's like fat and skinny.
You know?
You gotta share
Cleveland,
it around.
Cleveland was
no,
good.
Like,
it's a free trade Democrat.
All politics before the politics of today were even worse than today's politics, and today's politics are disgusting and bad because people are bad. But, there are presidents who are better and worse.
Yeah, and I think Jimmy Carter, I mean, we've all talked about this in various
ways.
We're
all Carter revisionists.
Carter had some really good policies. Reagan did a couple of things good. I mean, there's a lot to like about many presidents, but I think when you wrap it up in a ball, did they leave the country better? And I guess that's an easier way. The country was better after Reagan.
The country would have been better, though, if Reagan had stopped in his GE spokesman period, where he was just fantastic. He had just kind of discovered the freedoms, first of all. So he was really into that. And I just watched, for reasons that I swear had to do with work, the commercial that he and Nancy and Patty made for all the electric servants.
Patty's his daughter or his girlfriend.
The electric servants.
All the electric servants that GE brings into our homes.
Oh,
and it's this shameless exploitation of a tiny child to sell fucking toasters.
The kitchen of the future.
And I'm sold. I'm like, yes, do love these electric servants.
Thank you, Nancy. Bernie Leadon, who is one of the founders of the Eagles, dated Patty Davis Reagan. And he partly got kicked out of the band because they were sick of her politics, even though she was super anti-Reagan, who was governor.
Weren't her politics lefty?
Yeah, they were, but it was kind of like it was too much.
Too much for Don Henley.
Yeah, Don Henley.
I'm not putting up with this.
Yeah, and Glenn Frey. It's like, come on.
Glenn Frey?
Glenn Fry? Glenn whatever. Smuggler's Blues.
Okay, we're going to do one more topic.
That was for the music fans out there.
We've got a lot of a lot of really good loose ends in today's podcast, which I'm enjoying. But I do want to squeeze in one more topic
in the fast lane.
We get off. This one is, of course, sad and dismal, but it is dominating news. So we'll have Nick sing as I explain the terrible mass shooting in Texas to try and mitigate the evil of it. Over the weekend, Devin Patrick Kelly stormed a church in Sutherland, Texas. He killed over 20 people. He injured more than that. A nearby private citizen became aware of the shooting, chased him and shot him a couple of times, wounded him. Kelly, based on everything we know, should not have been able to purchase a firearm, at least on three different counts. He'd been discharged from the Air Force. He was discharged from the Air Force because he was convicted of domestic violence against his wife, which I think is a misdemeanor, right, and domestic violence against his stepson, which I believe is a felony charge. So right there, there's three things that should have knocked him out from that. On top of that, he escaped escaped a mental health facility at one point. The Daily Wire says that he was caught trying to sneak guns onto a base after making threats to his superior officers. So across the board, should not have been able to buy anything. Nonetheless, stormed and killed multiple people. Nick, given that all of these background checks failed, and these system of background checks failed, do you think we should scrap them entirely?
No. What has come out, at least in terms of the background check stuff, is that the military, which should be one of the easiest things to kind of factor into the national database that is run by the federal government, you know, they need to do a better job. They had both in terms of reporting to the gun database stuff into the criminal database, but also Jeff Flake, Senator Jeff Flake, noted that, there were virtually no domestic abuse convictions within military courts, like such a low number that the only conclusion can be that they're actually not prosecuting it or as such, et cetera. So that there's on two levels, things need to change and they need to change pretty quickly. One is that the military needs to become more serious about disciplining its members. And two, they need to integrate into the federal database much more quickly.
So just to be clear then, you think that the background checks which are in place are good. It's just that they're not being properly administered.
They're not. It's not clear exactly how much they reduce crime and stuff like that, but that's the law and they would have caught him. And there are times, you know, that's the type of thing where, you know, that one of the arguments, which I think is pretty forceful, is that, you know, criminals break the law. So they're not going to, if, you know, they try to buy a gun legally at a Walmart or at a gun show or something and they can't, they'll be like, oh, okay, that's right. I won't commit mass murder. That's probably unlikely. But everything that you do to make it a little bit more complicated without
there's going to be a lazy would-be murderer. There is going to be some
margin. You raise the cost.
Matt, isn't it you who has this shtick about the myth of the magical database? Am I remembering that correctly? Because this powerful idea that we can make this perfect list where we keep all the bad peoples who shouldn't have the guns or be able to fly on the airplanes or immigrate to our country, and we'll just, once we get that list right, then we'll be safe. That's a crazy and utopian dream that cannot be.
You see a little bit of the streams crossing because we have this so close after the New York terrorism attack, and I mean it's a horrifying thing that two really bad things happen back to back. But the magic database fantasy on the right is that we can do extreme vetting. The magic database fantasy on the left is that we can have the background check to end all background checks. There was a question, I believe, at one of the most recent White House briefings of like, why can't we have extreme vetting for guns? And while though it's kind of a jackass moment, I actually want those streams to cross because it's thinking we should think through the problem that way and also see what are the gaps in our thinking as a result of that. I agree with Nick. I'm not against background checks and I think whatever that weird problem of the military not sharing or not including that is should be fixed yesterday. The majority of mass shooting events in the country, people pass the background checks. Yeah. Like in Las Vegas, the guy passed every background check. Unfortunately, the profile of these people are that they can do this. And yes, those who can't pass background checks, obviously, they're about to commit one of the most heinous crimes possible. I think, you know, they might also be the type of person who would circumvent the local gun law as well. But I don't think
or use a truck. I mean, like a rented pickup truck, right, like in New York. So
I don't think that's an argument for just kind of a nihilistic all laws are pointless. Let's not have any laws here. But I do think it calls for realism. What you're getting out of such an exercise. At least in this case, whatever fixing the gap in the enforcement or the application of this background check law would have had some potential effect on the underlying crime that people are discussing. That is actually kind of a rarity in mass shooting events. Usually the typical thing is like, we should have done X, Y, and Z. That wouldn't have made any difference at all. So at least it has that going for it. But, I think it's just a depressing and a horrifying and sobering thing that the five or six of the largest mass shootings in history have happened in the last 10 years. It is becoming kind of regular. And that is, even as, you know, gun violence and gun murder is down overall and a bunch of other things that we know very well, this thing, this person freaks out and shoots a hell of a lot of people in large numbers, that is just happening more. And it's really depressing.
I think, though, these background checks, I mean, this idea that these lists are sort of kind of a good idea, I kind of want to push back on that. I think they're primarily security theater, and I think that they do active harm, right? I mean, Jacob Sullum has written very powerfully about the idea of putting people with mental illness on these lists as like super discriminatory and dangerous.
Can you
expand on that? Because good to me at first blush.
There is no way that I would trust the state to not conflate all kinds of garden variety treatment for people who are not violent and not dangerous and, you know, have seen a psychiatrist or even had a mental health episode that was severe and maybe in their past, those people should still have Second Amendment rights. And the idea that...
I'm not that bothered by that,
The idea that we would trust the United States government, again, let's remember, as run by Donald motherfucking Trump right now, to make a list of people who don't get guns because one time they did something crazy or because they see a shrink... is super dangerous. That's the same as the reason we oppose this extreme betting stuff.
So I agree with you, particularly in this case, and the idea of expanding mental illness, where it could be, you know, being on an antidepressant, being all sorts of things, having smoked pot, and what does it do to patient confidentiality if doctors, you know, psychiatrists
will not. And in California, they're experimenting with that right now.
Having said all of that, like the idea of databases, and they're never perfect, et cetera, but there are certain things like, you know, and we take databases for granted when we go to the bank and we, you know, they're using a database to check our money.
But
that's
a different. I mean, I think the other thing, though, is if you want to prevent gun deaths, right, which is what we are actually trying to prevent.
Yes.
We are not trying to prevent mass killings because they are very, very rare and they don't
follow
pattern.
We'd like to prevent them, but that's
not
the run.
We are, but in terms of these policies, what we're actually typically trying to address is broader gun deaths. And then when you actually look at what gun deaths are, first of all, 2/3 of them are suicides. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about suicide. Let's not talk about somebody going crazy in Texas. Then when you break down the rest of the incidents, they basically, and this was a great piece by Leah Labresco in the Washington Post a few months back, they basically break down into young men between 15 and 34 who were killed in homicides. So that's drugs.
You get one more year.
Basically drug war, right? So let's talk about the drug war and then domestic violence, which
that's a big one. I think if you've been convicted of domestic violence, I'm happy to take away your Second Amendment rights.
And he was, and this is where, but the conviction wasn't in the database.
Right.
And I don't know about, like, if somebody who's convicted of, you know, domestic violence tries to get a gun, I don't know if that raises a flag that gets reported to anybody or if it's just the vendor is just like, I'm not going to sell to you. And I'm uncomfortable with a lot of this stuff for the reasons Catherine raises, that you don't want more of a surveillance state. But by the same token, we know it's not the gun and it's not most people, but there are certain people who probably should not be allowed to have guns.
I mean, I guess, you know? I think that all sounds reasonable and well-intentioned, but I have so little faith in the constitutional fair execution of anything that looks even remotely like the much less the background checks policies that we have right now, which we just witnessed in this shooting, are not well enforced and executed. And to expand those lists seems foolhardy.
What do you think the ramifications of that would be? I mean, is that a thing where some people that probably need a gun for self-defense don't get it? Or are you concerned that the state would actually confiscate all guns?
I think it is mostly pointless, not actively damaging, right? So I think it is mostly just that we will create giant bureaucracies that self-perpetuate, yep, that cost a lot of money, that don't achieve the ends they're supposed to achieve.
Or anything.
I think in some cases it will radicalize people. And I think those radicalized people who want to commit violence will still be able to get a gun because there are 300 million guns in this country and you can get a gun if you want a gun. So I don't think it prevents even the outliers, the most extreme cases, from getting guns in most cases. And I think that, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast, you don't get to decide whether or not a thing I think is fun is a thing that I am allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people have guns because they think they're fun and cool. And those people should be allowed to do things they think are fun and cool, even if it's not my taste.
Would you place any, like right now, machine guns are illegal? Would you, you would want to get rid of that?
Every podcast comes back to, yes, own a bazooka, amen,
USA. But hold on, there's a qualitative difference between, I think last time we had this discussion, Nick brought up that, like, you know, I have blazers, but I'm not going to kill anybody with a blazer. Like, it's like, what I consider fun is...
Right,
is
you mean a jacket, like a suit jacket. Blazer.
Yeah. Blazer also sounds like a cool name for a cool kind of gun, maybe.
I don't know what
I don't know.
But I mean, like, there is, in terms of just it being fun, it's something fun that's designed to kill people, right? So, like, it is a qualitative thing.
That doesn't mean anything. It's not designed to kill people. It's
a gun?
Part of an army.
Like if you've got, like, a semi-automatic or you've got an automatic, which is also illegal, as I understand it. I mean, that's not...
No, semi-automatics are legal.
Semi-automatics are, right? But they're designed for killing people most of the time, right?
There have been fewer than 90 incidents in the FBI's formal definition of mass killings in the last 3 decades. And the fact that our gun control debate is focused on those incidents is total madness.
The gun control debate should not be... I mean, it is worth... pondering why, as Matt pointed out, you know, 5 of the deadliest mass shootings, like they're not going up in number, but they are getting more deadly. Are there basic, you know, common sense things that you can do to help prevent that? But again, it's like these are statistically vanishing events. So it's hard to make any kind of, you know, statement about policy or anything based on them.
And we are going to gravitate towards the novelty and the horrific more than we're going to gravitate towards the standard statistics. Like Catherine just brought up ending the drug war, reforming the drug war would probably be the single best thing you could do to limit.
Well, there's also
and let's
question.
All end on that point of agreement. We love drugs. The end.
All right. Well, we'll do that. We love drugs. And in the drug war, that'll solve a lot of things. Guys, thank you. It's been fun to talk to you. Thank you for listening. This is the Reason Podcast. And please like and subscribe to us on iTunes.